Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at theopenhouse.net.au blog site.
Okay, here's a story. June 7, 1964, and a brand new chapter of the Ku Klux Klan is meeting to discuss what they see as a disturbing wave of blacks and communists hitting the streets of Mississippi. And so they plan this counterattack against what they see as the evil civil rights movement, and they marshal all their rifles and their pistols and their shotguns and start deploying their horse-riding guards, even aerial surveillance they factor into the whole mission. And within the month, three civil rights leaders are murdered execution style. Now that racism, that hatred of groups like the KKK, it's bad enough, isn't it? But the most shocking aspect of this story is that this KKK chapter were actually meeting in a church when they planned this. And to make it even worse, they were praying to Jesus as they started planning. It's an extreme example, but it does raise this question. How can people who read the Bible and pray to Jesus live lives that are so different from his lifestyle? Michael Frost has been with us for the last couple of weeks, helping us to rediscover the life, message, and mission of Jesus. Tonight we're looking at how a radical rediscovery of Jesus actually transforms our spirituality, and I think we probably need it more than ever. Michael, welcome back again.
Thanks, Sheridan.
Really is an extreme story. You actually start the book, Re-Jesus, a Wild Messiah from Missional Church, with three or four of these kinds of stories, which are very disheartening, of people who, in the name of Jesus, were actually doing these kinds of atrocious acts. It's an extreme example, and it might be easy for us to say, well, I'm not the KKK, I've never done anything as bad as that. How else, though, do you think that we may actually do something similar, miss the mark, miss the model?
Well, I mean, I think it was last week or the week before, we talked about how we often let Jesus be captive to our deepest needs or deepest longings. But another way of looking at it is that we also make Jesus captive to our deepest fears or our deepest hates. And it can be the case that we decide to, you know, we have, in the case of the KKK, a deeply racist view on the world, and that dominates our thinking. And so what we do is we shoehorn Jesus into that, and Jesus becomes the one who hates blacks or Jews or civil rights workers as much as we do. Now, as you say, it's an extreme example, but there's also a sense, I think, in which we can have Jesus hating the people we hate. And your listeners might say, oh, I don't hate anybody, but it might be that we, you know, we can't imagine Jesus showing the same grace to Islamic terrorists or to homosexuals or to anybody else that we might have decided doesn't deserve our love. So it's a classic case of allowing our fears to take Jesus captive and to haul him along in that venture. Now, he won't allow himself to do that, but it happens all the time. Not only at the beginning of that book do we tell that story, but we talk about being in some extraordinary cathedrals with amazing, amazing wealth displayed in the glory of Jesus. But one of them in particular, a church I visited in Moscow, the whole church, the whole cathedral basically is a testimony to a particular armed conflict between the Russians and the French. And so here is Jesus being again kind of hauled into sanctifying their hatred of the French or their joy at defeating them in battle. Well, you know, it's about us being in charge, isn't it? It's not about us being taken captive by Jesus. It's about us taking him captive to our own ends.
That was the first time that we got together and started talking about those images of Jesus we had. And at the end, we were talking about how can we have our images of Jesus that we've grown up with or seen in the movies or in the icons, whatever it might be, recalibrated to the real person of Jesus. And you said, look, it's so simple, so radical, but still so simple, is just read the Gospels. But we can still do that and yet still not live the way he did. This kind of phrase that we've had a couple of times mentioned across the last few weeks as well, we can worship Jesus without following him. That disconnect that seems to happen.
Yeah, look, I wouldn't want to imply that you just read the gospel through once and bingo, you know, you're suddenly living just like Jesus did. It's a lifelong process. I think it was Soren Kierkegaard who said that he thought Christians reminded him of schoolboys that turned to the answers at the back of the mathematics book without actually wanting to work the thing out. And so you don't read the gospels like it's the answers page in the mathematics book. You know, here's the 10 things I do to live like Jesus. I think it's a reading, a rereading, a constant marinating of your soul in the stories, in the Gospels of Jesus, and allowing them to, like a mathematics equation to be worked out over time. Indeed, Paul talks about us working out our salvation. It's a lifelong commitment to embracing the spirituality that we find in the Gospels.
In the book, you take a fair bit of time to describe that God actually has the right to claim all of our lives. And when I say all of our lives, so often we kind of compartmentalize our lives into the spiritual, and then there's the everyday, there's the work and everything like that. But no, actually, if we're going to be people who follow after God, who follow after Jesus as the incarnation of God, well, then it actually affects our finances, our relationships, even our career choices at times. And yet, you also describe in quite a nice way, in many ways actually, that we tend to want to wriggle out of that. And we do it through a number of different ways. Just run us through some of the ways that we can typically, I guess, try to subvert Christ's claim over every domain of our lives.
Well, we do it in all sorts of ways. I mean, we can do it through a sort of a hyper sense of religiosity, so that religious practices, whether it's the mass or the church service or the church building, that's where God operates. That's where it's the only place where God operates, the only place I could meet God. So in a sense, I kind of squeeze God into that space, but he's not at work or the football field or the garden or the bedroom or anything like that. Another way, a classic way, I think that all sorts of religions do this, is through idolatry. It's like I limit my God to the particular idol. Now, Christianity has always been very suspicious of idolatry, but there is a sense in which we can even turn, buildings or pulpits or communion tables or into, in a sense, an idol. It's a place through which God comes to me, and he doesn't come through any other way. I guess one way to put this quite simply is it's a sort of a compartmentalizing of our religious faith. And you just mentioned it then, you talked about he's in church, but he's not at the office with me. But the thing about Jesus you've got to remember is Jesus was a Jew, and Jesus came from a Hebraic worldview, and that the Jews believe that there is one God and he is God over all. And when that gift of monotheism, one godness, came to the world through the Jews, it was radical, because up until that point, you had a god for the river and a god for fertility and a god for the sun, a god for the rain, a god for that mountain, a god for this mountain. You were forever, having to make offerings and say prayers. And your wife didn't have any children, or the river dried up, or it never rained. You had to second guess, which prayer didn't I say? Oh, my gosh, which god did I offend? It was highly neurotic. It was constant fearfulness. And then the Jews come along and they say, well, actually, our God is the God of the river and the mountain and the fertility and this and that. And it's all one God overall. And there were sacrifices and prayers to be made, but it wasn't constantly being afraid I may have stepped on the edge of the river without saying my special prayers. Well, that was an extraordinary gift. And then Jesus comes along and says, I embody that God. I am that God, now presented to you in human form. I have control over every domain of your life. Now, that sounds bad. That sounds like, oh, he's in control. But what he's saying is, I am your friend and your savior, your Lord, your rock, your redeemer, at work, making love to your partner, gardening, swimming, going to the art gallery, whatever it might be. I am present, and all of that is my world. Well, now, I just don't know how many Christians have fully embraced the radical nature of that. We still talk about the house of God. Welcome into the house of God. We actually welcome God into the house of God.
Yes.
I've been in
we
churches.
We welcome you here. Oh,
yeah,
yes,
and you
too.
Just think to yourself, well, for goodness sake, where was he before you welcomed him in? And the idea that he's fixed in certain zones is actually very, very unhelpful in our spirituality. A full Christian spirituality, like a full Jewish spirituality, is one that recognizes that God is Lord over all. There's no domain in our lives or our experience that God does not demand lordship and presence over.
This is Open House Across the Nation. Michael Frost is with us, co-author of Read Jesus, A Wild Messiah for a Missional Church, talking about how a rediscovery of Jesus in a radical way actually changes our spirituality. Now, when we start talking about that, though, that's when we do start to wriggle out, isn't it? Because actually, do I want Jesus to actually be Lord, boss, the one who is over my finances or the way that I live? Do I want that? That's probably when I start bringing in those other little levers that I can pull to say, oh, actually, no, as long as I do my quiet time in the morning, I should be all right.
Yeah, and also not only that, but the other way that we do it is we say, oh, okay, yeah, God is at work with me, and the way he reveals himself is by giving me opportunities to witness or to evangelize to my work colleagues. Well, I don't doubt that that would be one of the ways in which God would reveal his grace through you in your workplace, but there's also something about how just enjoying your work is a way of honoring God in him being there at work with you. Mm. Planting and tending a beautiful garden can be an act of worship. It's a way of saying, God, you are Lord over all things, you know. I mean, being a good parent, riding a great wave, painting a great painting. I mean, these are not godless or banal or somehow kind of profane things to do. They're potentially places where God is present. And I'd love us to see us develop a much richer spirituality than just God's with me in church or if I'm sharing the gospel with somebody. I mean, you have a look at what Jesus did. I mean, he had transfiguration happens on a mountain. His greatest sermon happens on the side of a hill. He can preach in a boat in the middle of the lake. He can see God in the lilies of the field. He can see God at work in a child in his midst. I mean, it's all grist to the mill for Jesus. I mean, God is everywhere, all over the place. Now, he does go to the temple. He thinks God is present in the temple too. Well, if God's present at the lake, well, he's present in the temple. Don't question about that. He's everywhere. So don't get me wrong. I'm not saying God isn't in your church or in your pulpit or in your church service. Of course he is. If I think he's present in the pub, well, I also think he's present in the cathedral. But let's not lock him in the cathedral and imagine that's the only place that we could meet him.
Yeah. So this spirituality word that we're using, how actually our lives can be formed and shaped. In fact, the Apostle Paul talks about that if we allow him, Jesus will actually transform us into his image. Now, that's quite a fascinating idea. You go back to the Old Testament and that phrase from God, be holy, be different, be set apart, as I am holy, different, set apart, that he is the model. We are actually to follow him. He's to be our character model that we actually line up against. And then Jesus comes and says, well, actually, if you see me, you've seen the Father. I'm the embodiment of that God. So then Jesus becomes the model. He is the one that we are to emulate. Now, practically speaking, Michael, when it comes to those practices that we can do to actually start to have our lives, our activities, our decisions, our emotions start to more and more emulate Jesus. It's the Holy Spirit's work. It's God's Spirit who works in us to make us more like him, of course, but you know, he uses our participation. Where do we go? How can we do it? How can we start recalibrating our lives around him?
Well, maybe it's about sort of scrubbing the whiteboard clean and starting all over again. I mean, the idea that I emulate Jesus because I have a quiet time and I look for opportunities to witness and I go to church every Sunday. I don't mean to mention those things as though they're inappropriate or unhelpful, but if we just boil it all down to just those things, is that really the trick? Well, okay, take those things, go and have a look at the Bible and find how much Jesus did that. Jesus certainly witnesses, but for him, witness can be seen in feeding the hungry. It's where his witness to his divinity, to his messiahship, is found in his befriending the friendless, releasing the oppressed. It includes speech, but it also includes action and love and grace. In terms of study, well, yes, Jesus does get up in the mornings at various points and go out early and praise. It looks like a kind of a quiet time thing. But as I said before, he could say, you know, look at the lilies of the field. That's that just taught me or reminded me that that God provides for us. You know, all of the world belongs to God as far as Jesus is concerned. And it's not ever limited to his particular devotional study life. So I say, well, line your life up, have a look at Jesus and see what he would do. Now, we can't die for the sins of the world like he did, but he does ask us to take up our cross. So any act of sacrifice or service or grace in the cause of somebody else is a Jesus-like work. Have a look at what else Jesus invites us to do. Jesus parties with sinners and tax collectors. Clearly, engagement in the lives of people is a legitimate thing. Jesus does it. So it's about looking at Jesus, if you like, as the template. We'll never be as perfect as Jesus. We're not the Messiah. There's only one Christ, thank goodness. But seeking to approximate that shape as best as we possibly can. And it might mean, I think we said this a few weeks ago, it might mean that you're not necessarily the best behaved person in church if you start doing that. You know, seriously, it might mean you end up hanging around with some unsavory people. Now, just on this, I have had people say to me, oh, you know, my pastor gets all upset about me because I go to the pub and hang out with my friends and he says I should be in church. And I said, well, why are you in the pub? What are you doing in the pub? And very often, when push comes to shove, they're in the pub because they want to meet a girl and have a drink. And, you know, so I say, look, don't sanctify that behavior and make out you being some great Jesus type character. Why was Jesus in the pub? He was in the pub to show love, to demonstrate grace, to point people to his own messiahship or his own divinity. Now, he seemed to have a good laugh and enjoy people's company as well, but we shouldn't pretend that, you know, our preferences for going surfing instead of going to church is that's because that's what Jesus would do. If you are going to do what Jesus would do, have a look at the Gospels. Do what Jesus would do. It might take you to some unusual places, but don't just go there because they happen to be your own interests. Go sacrificially as a little Jesus, as we say in the book, as a carbon copy of Jesus in this world, transforming it the way he did.
Yes. The radical Jesus who transforms our spirituality. Well, next week we'll wrap it up. It's been a great series. It's been really enjoyable, Michael. Next week, how that radical rediscovery of Jesus actually changes the church. And I guess this is where you focus a good deal of the book. We'll, I guess, wrap it up into one session next week.
Okay.
Talk to you then. Yeah, Michael Frost, director of Sydney's Tinsley Institute and author of Re-Jesus, A Wild Messiah for a Missional Church.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit theopenhouse.net.au.